This is Precepts Audio Message PA 109. Nathan C. Johnson, Bible Teacher. For all those who love our Lord Jesus Christ in truth.
2 Timothy chapter 3. Now, 2 Timothy chapter 3 takes up this issue of the last days. And in verse 1, Paul speaks and he says, "This know also, that in the last days perilous time shall come." Or, in the resultant version, "Be aware of this also, that in the concluding days dangerously violent time shall come." So, Paul has something he wants Timothy to know in his writing to him here. And he wants him to know about the last days. Now, this word last in the Greek, it's eschatos. So these are the eschatos days. The last days are the eschatos days in Greek. Now, that word definitely means last, but it doesn't always mean, like we'd say, our last dollar. Sometimes it takes on the character of the Hebrew word akarith, which is the Hebrew word for last, and has to do with more of the result rather than necessarily the last. And I think I used the example last time of when Christ talked about the man who had the demon cast out of him, presumably by one of the Pharisees' disciples, and then the unclean spirit went out and searched for some other home, couldn't find one, so he went and returned to his house that he came out of and found it was all swept and ready for him. So he went and found seven other spirits that were worse than himself. And so then all eight of them moved into that man, and Christ says that the last state of that man is worse than the first. Well, we know that wasn't the last state that man was ever in. He could still have demons cast out of him, or who knows what would happen. Nor was having one demon in him the first state he was ever in. He wasn't born that way or anything like that. So here we see that first means former and last means resulting. And so that's what I believe this phrase, the last days, means. It means the resulting days. Now, if we would compare the last days here with the last days in Acts chapter 2, where Peter talks about the last days, we'll see that those last days are glorious and wonderful last days. Whereas these last days, as we read through it, these last days are fierce or perilous or dangerously violent. And so this has caused many people to wonder, why does Acts 2 say that the last days are wonderful and God's pouring out His Spirit and doing all these wonderful things, whereas 2 Timothy 3 says that the last days are perilous and dangerously violent and have all these wicked things going on? Well, I think the reason is when we understand that they're the resulting days, that we understand that we have to ask the question, the result of what? And the last days in Acts chapter 2, I believe, are the last days or the resulting days of all God's long work with Israel and with His people, culminated, by Christ's death on the cross, which brings in the kingdom of God, God's government on earth and what God has always been planning to do. Whereas these last days are actually the days that result from God's long display of grace with mankind. And as Isaiah tells us, if you show grace to the wicked, they will not turn from their wickedness. And when God shows grace to people today, many people just take advantage of that to become more and more wicked. So the result of God showing nothing but grace for many, many years, several thousand years now, is that people just get more wicked. And so the resulting days of that, the last days of that, involve these perilous or these dangerously violent times. Now, I believe that these last days are the resulting days, and they are the concluding days of this dispensation of grace that we live in, and that these are the last days of this dispensation before God breaks in history and brings His kingdom, His government to earth. Now, we know that this dispensation of grace has lasted for somewhere around 1950 years now. And so it's been going on for a long time, but of course God has no set time period for this dispensation to continue. So how do we know when this dispensation might come to an end? Well, all we know is that God tells us what the resulting days and ultimately the concluding days of this dispensation will be in this passage. Now, this passage doesn't give a lot of prophecies about events, but what it gives us is characteristics of the people who will be living in those last days. And it actually gives 21 characteristics. And Otis Sellers has called this the syndrome of the last days. And he compares it to a disease and diagnosing a disease. When you diagnose a disease, you know, there are multiple illnesses that could give you, for example, a fever or a cough or a sore throat and so forth. But as you add symptoms together, then you can diagnose the disease. If you say, well, if you get 5 symptoms or 10 symptoms, you add them all together and you can probably guess what disease it actually is if you can figure out enough symptoms. Well, here we actually have 21 symptoms of the way men will be in the last days. Now, these 21, I wouldn't say that they're necessarily unique to the last days, and that is that there always have been people who have been like this or have done these things. But these 21, when they're all together, when they're all particularly noticeable and universal, give us the syndrome of the last days. Now, of course, the difficulty always is that we're most familiar with our own culture, our own country, our own people. And if this is truly a worldwide phenomenon, we have to say, well, can I really examine worldwide and see if this syndrome is true worldwide? And then also, of course, our lifespans are very short. Seems pretty long when you're young, but the older you get, the shorter you realize that this life is short. And when you consider that this dispensation has been going on for 1950 years, we're only seeing a very brief period of it. So it makes it hard. Have these things changed? Are we getting more like this? But I do believe as we examine these things that it does appear that these things are becoming more and more symptomatic. And so I think it is likely that we're living in the last days of this dispensation of grace. Now, I can't definitely prove it 100%. That's the thing about a syndrome, trying to diagnose something, is that it's not a definitive test. It's just you examine the symptoms and see if they match with your understanding of this illness. It's not like when some tests that our medical profession can do nowadays that can actually find the disease and look at it and see what it is. It's just trying to diagnose from the symptoms, and so we try to do that. But I believe that we are living in the last days of this dispensation of grace, but of course, who knows how long those might be. It could be 100 years. And if so, when did they start? You know, in an almost 2,000-year dispensation, the last part of it could be pretty long. So even if we are living in the last days, who knows how long that means we have left. But these 21 symptoms of mankind in the last days give us a picture of what that time period is going to be like immediately before God breaks in. And we'll see that he'll tell us that these days immediately precede God breaking in and putting a stop to all this wickedness. So verse 2, the King James Version has it, "For men shall be lovers of their own selves, covetous, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy." The Resultant Version has it, "For men shall be self-lovers, lovers of silver, ostentatious, haughty, calumniators, stubborn toward parents, without grace, unbenign." So here he starts listing these 21 symptoms of the way people will be in the last days. And the way he starts it out with is he says, "For men shall be." Now the argument has always been, does this mean all men? Or does this mean just believers? Or as dispensationalists we could say, does this mean just Israelites? But I would suggest that the context being the last days, and certainly we can never leave Israel out of the picture, even in a post-Acts 28:28 book. But still, in the last days, when he says men shall be, it seems to open this up to the widest possible application that This is talking about everyone. This is will be the generally be the characteristics of people. Now, again, this is a syndrome. It doesn't mean every person on earth is going to be this way. But if you're living in the last days and you are this way, you're just going along with the flow of this world, which is what most people do. And unfortunately, some people who are believers, or at least Christians, quote-unquote, go along with these things just as much, and we're probably all caught up in the flow of this world from time to time. Unfortunately, none of us always live perfectly for God as we should. But I think this might be characteristic even of people who claim Christ, but I think that this has the widest possible application, and it's talking about the way people will be in the last days. It's not narrowing it down to believers. It's not narrowing it down to Israelites. It's just saying this is the way that people will be. The word anthropos just means people. So what will people be like? Well, here are the 21 symptoms. So number two symptom, lovers of their own selves, or self-lovers. And Seller says of this that these five words are just one in the Greek, philautos. And it means lover, basically lover of yourself. It describes those who care unduly or supremely for themselves and who feel that any desire within themselves justifies any moral action. So you love yourself, and your love for yourself is supreme to all other things. And you think that anything you might do is justified as long as it pleases yourself. Well, certainly that's a characteristic that we see that's widespread today. It's not necessarily the characteristic of everyone, but it's the characteristic of many, and perhaps we could say it's even the characteristic of this culture, and becoming more and more so as time goes on, that people are self-lovers, love themselves more than anyone or anything else. King James has it covetous. Now, the word here in the Greek is philargyros, and Seller says it means lovers of money, but more specifically means a lover of silver. So a lover of money or a lover of silver. Now, certainly we see today that this is a characteristic, that people love money, love wealth. That's true in our culture, certainly, that people love wealth. Now, whether the lover of silver part is specific to silver or whether it just is put for coinage or for any kind of money, it's hard to say. Sellers thought that maybe that the silver was significant. But certainly there are times when silver is popular.
So it might specifically have something to do with silver, but then again, it might be more general and just be talking about the fact that men will be lovers of money. And certainly we see that today in the way men are willing to do just about anything, it seems, to enrich themselves, to get more wealthy. They're willing to take any risk in gambling. They're willing to be dishonest in business, so on and so forth, anything to get more money. So men shall be philargyros, lovers of money, lovers of silver. Then the next one is boasters. Sellers has translated that ostentatious in the resultant version. And he says the Greek word used here, alazones, has to do with those who speak and think more of themselves than the reality justifies. It speaks of the ostentatious, the empty pretenders, those given to pretentious parades. This characteristic is seen in most religions today. So, the idea of boasters here is the idea of those who are ostentatious, those who pretend to be more than they actually are, those who put on a show and pretend to be someone great when really they're not. Reminds me in the book of Acts, in Samaria, in Acts chapter 8, where Simon the sorcerer, he gave out that he was some great one. And so the people all said, he's the great power of God. This man is the great power of God. And he was giving out that he was some great one too. Well, he was being ostentatious. He was pretending to be someone great, something great, more than he actually was. And so that's what this word boasters means. Someone who is ostentatious, pretends more of themselves than the reality justifies. And the next one is proud. Or Sellers is translated in his resultant version as haughty.
Those who take more honor to themselves than they really deserve. That's certainly a characteristic of people today. They're always willing to take honor that's given to them, even if they don't really deserve it, and they know they don't deserve it. They're proud, they're haughty. This type of person is common. Blasphemers. And that is literally pretty much the Greek word taken over into English. It's blasphemoi. And so we turn it into blasphemers. And we usually think of blasphemy as someone who speaks against God. The resultant version, he has calumniators. And he says, it's one who accuses falsely and maliciously, one who seeks by aspersion and vilification to destroy the name or reputation of another. This is now normal practice in political warfare. It is the chief tool of fanatical extremists. So it's basically a person who accuses someone falsely, accuses them of some crime or of some vice that isn't really true of them, and they use it to destroy another person's reputation, destroy another person's honor, and they do it to benefit themselves if they feel this other person is a threat to them or an opponent or a rival. They will spread any story, tell any lie in order to destroy the reputation of that person and clear the way for their own advancement. So this is a calumniator, one who speaks falsely and accuses falsely for their own benefit, their own gain. So, again, we see people like this. As Sellers points out, that's very common in the political world. And unfortunately, it can also be common in the religious world as well. Then we have disobedient to parents. Or, result version, he is it stubborn toward parents. And he says the word translated disobedient here is apathēs. It means to be stubborn or unpersuadable. Or to be more specific, to be in obstinate opposition. There is no social condition that is quite as prominent and conspicuous in the world today as is the obstinate opposition of children toward parents. And certainly this is something that has become more true now than it was in the past. I think in many ways this has been spread because of the breakdown of families and single-parent families, that children become obstinate and stubborn toward their parents. Now again, it's not every child throughout the world, it's not universal, but it's a characteristic that seems to be more common now than it ever was in the past. And nowadays it seems that people talk about it, they just expect teenagers to become rebellious. It's like, oh, it's just normal, it's a phase they go through. Well, you go back 100, 200 years ago, nobody expected the children to ever be rebellious. That was a really, really bad person if the child was rebellious. A really, really bad child, and everybody would look down on them. Nobody expected a child to be rebellious. Well, now it's they just seem to expect it. You say, oh, it's just a normal thing. Well, it's not a normal thing. And it's something that has become common in our day, and yet it was not so common in times past. So this is one thing that does seem to be more common today, and it does seem to be spreading around the world. They've talked about even cultures like Japan, where they've traditionally respected their elders, there'll be rebellion. Of course, in that culture, the young people tend to rebel in groups, which seems kind of weird to us. Most people today, or in our society, rebel individualistically. In Japan, they rebel in groups, but this seems to be going around the world, the revolt and rebellion of young people. And that's the idea here of they're just stubborn and obstinate and in opposition to their own parents, argue with their parents, are stubborn and disobedient toward them. Now again, not everybody is this way, but this is the syndrome of the last days. It's a syndrome the way men generally are, the way people generally are in the last days. disobedient or stubborn toward their parents. So that's number 7. Then number 8, unthankful is the King James translation. Sellers translates it without grace. And this word is the base of the word is the word for grace, charis, not the word for thanks. And it's acharistoi, which is the word for grace with the prefix a in front of it. And we even use that sometimes in English, put a in something, like someone who doesn't believe in the millennium is an amillennialist. And so with the a in front of it, acharistoi, it means without grace or graceless. So these are people who are without grace. And Seller says it means ungrateful, and it speaks of those who have no proper sense of feeling for favors received and no willingness to acknowledge or repay a benefit. However, this word may also mean without grace and can be used to describe anything that lacks attractiveness or charm. So he says it's without gratitude for favors. So charis being favor toward those who don't deserve him, acharistoi, can carry with it the idea of not being grateful for favors, for grace you've been shown. Just someone does something very gracious to you and you just take it for granted, aren't even thankful for it. Or it can mean that you yourself are just without the characteristics of grace. You wouldn't think of doing anything for someone unless you thought you were going to get something back for it. And, of course, doing things for others with no thought of return is a very gracious thing to do, and people who are without grace just would never think of doing something like that. Always want some repayment for anything they've ever done. So this is the idea here. It's without grace, either without gratitude for favors or just without gracious characteristics yourself. Now we're on number 9, which finishes up this verse 2, is unholy in the King James Version. Or Sellers has it unbenign. And he says that unholy is a very poor translation of the Greek word anosios. And it is. That doesn't have anything to do with the word hagios that we usually have translated as holy. It's anosios. Sellers says that means unbenign or malignant. He says, anyone is malignant who is actuated or characterized by virulent ill will or extreme malevolence. This word describes those who are disposed to do harm, to inflict suffering, or to cause distress. There are so many of this kind today that it is a cause of anxiety to legislators, educators, peace officers, and parents. So it's those who are malevolent toward others. And malevolence means a tendency to just want to do your worst. To want to do the worst you can possibly do towards someone. Malevolence just means to be disposed to do harm. To have ill will toward others. Just a hateful attitude. To love to inflict suffering or pain. And so this is something that, again, it's not universal, but we see that there are many people who do this. And certainly in the growth of child abuse, for one thing, children generally being at the mercy of the adults around them, when the adults around them are anosios, when they are malignant or malevolent, they will harm those children. And sometimes they just seem to do their worst toward innocent children, sometimes even their own children or the children of those associated with them. And that's just a characteristic of this unbenign or malignant attitude. But it also just enjoying inflicting harm or suffering on others. So that's number 8. So this is a very grim, a very sad list. But I think as we look at the state of the world we're in, we see that there are many people with this kind of character, at least some of these characteristics, and we do see all of these characteristics present. And of course, the question always is, how much more prevalent could they get? How much worse could things get? But it seems characteristics of people are moving more this way all the time. Verse 3. Without natural affection, truce breakers, false accusers, incontinent, fierce, despisers of those that are good. The resultant version, he has it calloused, implacable, devils, uncontrollable, brutal, despisers of goodness. So, number 10, which is without natural affection, or calloused. Seller says these three words are one in the Greek, and the Greek word is ostrogos. It means calloused or hardened in sensibility and feeling. Every case of child abuse and every abortion gives testimony to the prevalence of this condition. So without natural affection, it's just having your feelings hardened like a callus. Of course, we all know what a callus is when you get a callus on your feet or hands or somewhere where you're worked a lot with it, and at first maybe your skin is very tender there, and then after a while you build up a callus. Well, these people are calloused in their feeling. They've built a callus over their feelings so that they don't feel the natural feelings that they should feel, the affection that they should feel for the people that they should feel it for. So they don't feel the love and the care and so forth. And certainly that comes out, as Sellers points out, in people's actions towards children. Even if it's not your own children, it seems that there should be some level of care for a child just because he is a child, but certainly toward your own children or children you're responsible for. Or what about the feeling of a pregnant mother should have toward her unborn baby? And yet many people show the callousness of their hearts, the fact that their feelings that they should be having are just calloused, like a callus on a hand or a foot, that they don't feel the feeling that they should have. So people are calloused, and we see that so much today. Like you say, in the millions of abortions, and that's a phenomenon that isn't worldwide, but has certainly spread to many, many, many lands, and the abuse of children and so forth, it just goes on in many places. We don't know if it goes on everywhere, but it certainly goes on in many, many countries and nations and cultures around the world. Then number 11 is truce breakers in the King James. Implacable, he has it in the resultant version. He says that truce breakers is a very poor translation of aspandos. Means implacable, and it's so translated in its only other occurrence in Romans 1:31. It has a reference to those who are not satisfied until they have done their worst. Such people are devoid of any pity or feeling that would cause them to relent and restrain through compassion the fury or violence of their rage, hatred, or hostility. In the commission of crimes, more people are being beaten, stomped, or kicked to death than has ever been known in the recorded history of mankind. So it's people who are implacable. Once they start out to do a bad thing, there's just no stopping them. They don't pause at some point and say, you know, I really shouldn't be doing this, or haven't I gone far enough? No, they just keep right on going until they've done their worst. They're implacable. They start doing a bad thing and they just will not stop until they've done the worst they can possibly do. And this seems, unfortunately, as he says, particularly in criminals, in crimes, we see this coming out. This is a characteristic of our days, that people are implacable. But we also can see it, for example, in people who start out into addictions, and they seem to just go into them wholeheartedly and seem to want to do their worst and other things. They start out on the path of sin and just keep going until something forces them to stop. Then number 12 is false accusers in the King James, or devils, he has it in the resultant version. Now this word is diabolos. It's probably familiar to us even if we don't know the Greek. It's the word that is translated devil. Usually 35 out of 38 times in the New Testament in the King James it's translated devil. Here it's translated false accusers. Now the word devil, we know that's usually used for Satan. It's a Greek word, diabolos. We don't find it in the Hebrew. But it means a false accuser. And the devil, we know, is a slanderer, a false accuser, a liar. And he says, Sellers says, it means a slanderer, one who speaks evil for the purpose of injuring and without regard for the truth. However, the word devil seems to properly characterize many men today when their acts are considered. So it means those who falsely accuse. And we see that some of these, as we saw earlier, calumniators, some of these seem to tie together. Those who speak evil of others, who try to destroy others through their words, certainly is akin to false accusers. So some of these seem to be a little bit fine distinction or describing perhaps slight variations on the same theme. But these are devils, slanderers, those who speak evil for the purpose of injuring and don't care about what the truth is. So devils. Number 13 is incontinent in the King James, or uncontrollable in the Resultant Version. It's the word akrates. Now, a continent person, well, what does incontinent mean? Well, what's a continent person? A continent person is the one who restrains himself, restrains their desires, restrains their wants. And the incontinent are those who do not constrain their desires. And we can see that is common today. Those who don't restrain their desire for food. Of course, we can apply it to sexual desire. And there are many people today who don't restrain that in any manner. It's seen in alcoholism and drug use, those who don't restrain these things. Gambling becomes a compulsive thing or a thing that's unrestrained. Or even today, and we talk about computer gaming and people who get addicted to that, don't even know how to restrain themselves on. We've even heard in Japan of some people who play games until they die and just won't stop, but just don't control themselves, don't control their desires. That's an incontinent person. They have no control, or they take no control, whether they would, could if they would. They take no control over their desires. They just do whatever they can to satisfy those desires and don't restrain themselves in any way. So that's an incontinent person. Certainly see that common today. Then, number 14 is fierce in the King James. Resultant Version, he has it brutal. That's the Greek word anemeros. Seller says it means brutal, inhuman, or cruel. Civilization boasts of its long and gradual rise from a savage state, but at present it is faced with a truly savage spirit among men. The violence that is reported daily in the news is proof of this. So brutal, inhuman, or cruel. And brutality, what we call inhuman, although in reality it's all too human as far as fallen humanity is concerned. We like to think it's inhuman, but it's not. In fact, the things that we call inhumanity are almost exclusively properties of humans. We don't see animals doing to each other things that we call inhuman. So what makes us think this is inhuman? But in fact, what we would call inhuman acts that people shouldn't do but do to each other, brutal and cruel acts, are all too common. As Sellers points out in the news, we hear of this sort of thing all the time. People who are just brutal and savage and cruel towards each other do things that we have trouble imagining. Why would anyone do such a thing? So this is also characteristic of men in the last days. Despisers of those that are good. That's number 15. Or Sellers has it, despisers of goodness. And he says, despisers of those that are good, those six words are only one word in the Greek. That's philagathos. And most of these are just one word in the Greek. Sometimes it takes more than one to bring it into English. He says it means averse to the good or despisers of goodness. This describes perfectly all who would destroy every moral landmark and principle simply because they have no relish for that which is good. They call evil good and good evil. They put darkness for light and light for darkness. They put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter, as the prophet Isaiah so graphically declares it in Isaiah 5:20. On every hand today we find those who heartily approve wicked practices. Those who despise good are never neutral. They love wickedness. And so despisers of those that are good. And we can see that. Certainly we can see that in our culture and those people who are always constantly fighting to take our culture in an immoral direction. They want to break down all moral barriers, all moral boundaries, all moral standards. They want to make any family is okay. They want to make any morality is okay. Any sort of relationship is okay. And more and more, they want to break down what formerly would have been unthinkable and make it acceptable. Well, those are people who despise goodness. And as he says, these people are not neutral. They don't just say, well, we want to be left alone to be able to do our thing. No, they want approval. And they want more and more and more people to do their thing along with them. They want more and more people to do these wicked acts. And we see that certainly in those who are promoting homosexuality. They want approval, and they want this thing to grow. Those who promote promiscuity, and that's a battle that seems almost to be over nowadays. It becomes so common. Well, these people not only promote it, they want to make it commonplace, and it becomes more and more and more commonplace. Nowadays, it seems that some people... People would be surprised if you're engaged and aren't living together already. It seems they have no shame at all about admitting it, and they look at you rather strangely if you said you weren't already living together before you got married, if you're engaged. And we see that this has just become the norm. People almost think nothing of it today. Well, at one point, this was something that was promoted by those who despise goodness, and now it's just become common on every hand. And now they're working on the next thing, it seems, which seems to be normalizing homosexuality. But these people despise goodness, and they just want to destroy every moral standard. And they work on them one by one. Well, that's one of the characteristics of men in the last days, is that they despise goodness. And we see people around us in every hand who have just exactly this characteristic. So that is number 14. Verse 4, King James Version. Traitors, heady, high-minded, lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. The Resultant Version has it, traitors, rash, conceited, lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. Then number 16, so traitors, the Greek word prodotes. Sellers says, this can best be understood when we consider that it is used to describe Judas Iscariot in Luke 6:16. It has a reference to all who today betray the Lord, his word, and his work. So these are betrayers, traitors, like Judas Iscariot was a traitor, betrayed the Lord. So these are traitors. And they would be traitors toward other men, traitors toward those they should be loyal to, but most significantly would be traitors toward God, would betray the Lord. And certainly believers are in the position to betray the Lord, or Christians at least, quote unquote, are more in a position to betray the Lord than those who have never owned him in the first place. So again, we get back to this question of, is this talking about believers or people in general? Well, I think it doesn't say traitors against the Lord, just traitors, and I think men have little loyalty. And certainly in the way people are not loyal to their marriage vows and tend to betray the person they claim they're going to love, honor, and cherish for the rest of their lives. We can see that is a betrayal, certainly. It is very common today. But this is another character. Number 15 is traitors. Heady, the King James Version has it, or rash, and that's number 17. It's the word propates in Greek. Seller says rash or headstrong. It means imprudent hastiness in word or action. It describes those who rush imprudently in pursuit of their own will. It is seen in the rush of the young to get married, in the rush of the married for divorce, in sudden changes of belief, precipitate disavowals of God and Christ. We see it in mobs and riots and in revolts. We can see it in nations that are seized with a sudden passion for war that none can explain. So, just a spirit of rashness or of haste, of making hasty decisions without really thinking it through. And, well, in our country, one way I can think of is the way people spend hastily without really thinking it through or making sure they can afford things. They just spend them and figure they'll pay for them later. But that it's all this in this idea of rash or headstrong, making decisions quickly and without proper thought. Number 18, then, is high-minded or conceited in the resultant version. Greek word is tufaomai. And Seller says it means conceited, but it has also the meaning of beclouded or besotted, as when something has made one blindly or stupidly foolish. This may have reference to those whose minds are deranged by the use of drugs, but it may have to do with the multitudes whose minds have become so beclouded and besotted by sin that they cannot think clearly in regard to any matter. So, it means conceited. It means conceited or arrogant, but it also means those who are just have their minds clouded, just besotted, like one who's drunken or besotted on drugs, deranged by drugs. So their minds are just clouded. Their minds are not right. They're foolish in their minds and conceited. So that's number 17. Lovers of pleasures more than lovers of God. And Sellers pretty much translates that one the same way. He says, the Greek word there is philidnos. And he says, the full description is that they are lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. Who could be so blind as to deny this manifest and extraordinary development seen everywhere today? Pleasure-loving more than God-loving. A more accurate description of man's present attitude could hardly be given. The love of pleasure is a social characteristic of the present time. And we can see that really clearly in the prevalence of entertainment today. You know, people in the past did not live and die for entertainment. Of course, there always was entertainment, but people spent a lot of their time working. You know, when you had a household, when you didn't have all the modern conveniences, a lot of time was spent working. Well, even time on a farm, a lot of your time is spent working. But in our day, people just give so much of their lives over to entertainment and television in every house, and people who seem to work during the day and then go home and spend all the time they possibly can just being entertained by the television or everything they want to do. Our society is so defined by entertainment. I say food really isn't to live, it's for entertainment. And we judge our food based on whether it entertains us or doesn't entertain us. And our free time, so many people give all their free time to entertainment, and their judgment of how they should use their free time is not does it value me, but does it entertain me? And entertainment, because of bringing that televisions into homes, quite frankly, it was and radios was really the first step, is brought entertainment to the masses. It could be constant entertainment. And we've become addicted to entertainment. And so we really are pleasure-loving. And loving pleasure more than loving God. So really, it is a characteristic of our society, and it's spreading around the world, of constantly wanting to be entertained, constantly wanting pleasure more than anything else. And the fact is that life isn't about having pleasure all the time. Often life is about working hard. But now in our culture and our societies, we tend to look for entertainment, constant entertainment. And I'm bored seems to be the common thing for children to say. I always want to be entertained. And so from very young, we're starting out loving entertainment. Well, there's nothing particularly wrong with entertainment in and of itself, but the problem is that we love entertainment more than we love God, far more than we love God. Now, of course, unbelievers don't love God at all. So we talked about, is this talking about believers or unbelievers? Well, believers love God, and yet the fact is that among Christians, and perhaps, unfortunately, even among true believers, who really wins out in the life of most? Do they spend more time in their relationship with God, or do they spend more time being entertained? If we really weighed it time versus time on the scale, which way would the scale tip? Well, I'm afraid the scale would tip toward entertainment and pleasure in most cases. We just don't want to spend that much time on God. And so how do you define how much you love God versus how much you love entertainment? Is it not fair to define on how much time you spend on the two? So loving pleasure more than loving God, I think that describes certainly the world loves pleasure and has little time to do with God, but even among believers, more love seems to be given to entertainment than to God. This is certainly true of today. Verse 5, having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof, from such turn away. Or, resultant version, having a form of devoutness, but denying the power thereof, from such turn away. Now this is number 20. Now about this, Seller says, the greatest religion on earth today is unbiblical and unspiritual Christianity, in which the forms of godliness predominate while the power of godliness is denied. Among professing Christians, there is a total ignorance of everything that is biblical. The prevailing view today is that it is important to have faith, but that it does not much matter in what or in whom. So people have a form, they have the outward show of godliness. They look like they're godly on the outside, they put on the show. But they deny that there's any real power in godliness. They deny the real power of it. And then Paul breaks in here to warn Timothy, say, from such turn away. Now this shows us, as I've said, that these things are particularly the syndrome of the last days, the characteristic of people in the last days, but that we shouldn't think that haven't always been people like this. And notice Paul even denies it. Warns Timothy, there were people like this in Timothy's own day, and he tells Timothy, turn away from people like that. Because there were people like that in Timothy's day. People who have a form, an outward show of being godly, but when it comes to the real power of being godly, they deny it. They don't want anything to do with that. And they want to go to church on Sunday and look good and say the right things and do the right things and say, I've been water baptized and I was confirmed and so on and so forth, but when it comes to living a godly life or having a real relationship with God or getting to know the Word, they have nothing to do with it. Well, this is a characteristic of people today throughout the so-called church, is they have the forms of godliness of what people think is godly, going to church, and maybe they're an elder in their church and on the board and singing in the choir and who knows what. But they don't really acknowledge the power of godliness, the power of a godly life, the power of a relationship with God. Now, certainly Timothy was aware of people like that. The people who had rejected him, some of them were no doubt like that and had him kicked out of Asia. But this is going to be a prevailing characteristic of people, that they will pretend to acknowledge godliness or appear to acknowledge godliness in outward forms, but they'll deny the real power of it, the real power of God, the real power of the truth. So that is characteristic, number 20, if we're going to have 21 and include perilous times as number 1. Number 6, or verse 6, King James Version. For of this sort are they which creep into houses and lead captive silly women, laden with sins, led away with diverse lusts. Or Seller says, these creep into houses and take into captivity silly women, laden with sins and led away with different desires. So this sort of people, and so he's kind of describing these who have this outward show of devoutness, but deny the power. So he says, of this sort of people, people I want you to turn away from, these people who have this outward form of godliness or devoutness, but deny its power, they're the kind of people who creep into houses and they lead captive silly women. I've heard it said that this is a very derogatory term. It's a term of, it's almost like saying contemptuous women. Just these stupid little women. So it's obviously not describing all women, but a certain type of woman. So these are the type of people who would creep into houses and find these foolish, contemptible women who are all laden down with sins and just led around by whatever strong desire they might have and take those women into captivity. Then verse 7, is ever learning and never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. So this type is always learning, increasing knowledge, increasing learning, and yet they don't learn what's really important. They don't learn what's really true. They never come to the knowledge of the truth. They keep learning and learning and learning, but the truth is beyond them. Now, if this wasn't describing the silly women and those who lead them away, that would be an interesting one to apply to everybody today, because with our growth of information technology, we seem to have more and more and more information. We learn and learn and learn, and yet none of that learning ultimately brings us to the truth. God's Word, the knowledge that we've, same knowledge we've had for thousands of years, is the only thing that brings to the knowledge of the truth. But we think we're so much smarter because of all this information. But this is describing these who have the form of godliness and deny the power. They creep into these houses, they find these contemptible women, and take them into captivity. Just led around by their desires, keep learning, 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 never really come to know and understand the truth. Now, verse 8, King James Version. Now, as Jannes and Jambres withstood Moses, so do these also resist the truth. Men of corrupt minds, reprobate concerning the faith. So this is number 21, which we could call the Jannes and Jambres syndrome. Now, Jannes and Jambres, this is very interesting because they're really only mentioned here. But these are ones who withstood Moses. And in the Jewish oral tradition at the time, for the tradition they had handed down, Jannes and Jambres were the names of the two magicians or the two leading magicians in Egypt. You remember when Moses came before Pharaoh and cast down a staff and became a snake, and the magicians cast down their staffs and they became snakes. Of course, then Moses' staff went and ate the other two snakes. But these two magicians were Jannes and Jambres. Now, we need to remember that in spite of the fact that no doubt much of the Hebrews' history came from the Bible, we do have other sources for history other than the Bible. Everything we know about history doesn't come from the Bible. And so we shouldn't expect the Jews to only know facts in the Bible as their history. They might have carried with them the names of these two magicians outside of the Bible and in other historical records or stories that they had. So, but this is very interesting, a case where 1,500 years later we learn the names of these two people that we never really learned back in the Old Testament. Jannes and Jambres. And just because it's not mentioned in the Old Testament doesn't mean it's not true. And certainly the Holy Spirit was there 1,500 years before, just as much as he was there when Paul was writing. And so this fact that they apparently knew the names of these magicians, he acknowledges it as being true. Now, what is this Jannes and Jambres syndrome? Well, they withstood Moses. Remember how I said it was they did it by counterfeiting Moses' miracles. When he cast down his staff and it became a snake, they cast down their staffs and they became snakes. Very interesting. When Moses turned all the water in Egypt into blood, they went out and found some water and they turned it into blood. Didn't really help Egypt's problem. It would have been better if they had turned it back into water. That would have helped Egypt. But they showed they could turn water into blood. When Moses brought frogs up on Egypt and plagued Egypt with frogs, the magicians did the same thing. Again, didn't really help anything, just brought more frogs and poor Egypt. But they showed they could do it too. So how did they withstand Moses? They withstood Moses by counterfeiting the truth. And of course, finally, when it got to the third plague then, the gnats, I believe it was, they tried and they couldn't do it. So they finally failed. But what they were doing was they were withstanding Moses by counterfeiting the truth. And they would say, God's miracles, we can do them too. And then they would do the miracles and use those to resist the truth. Seller says of this, these two appear in a lengthy statement. They have referenced the two magicians who stood before Pharaoh and reproduced the same miracles that Moses produced in confirmation of his divine mission and credentials. Everywhere today we find miracle workers who claim that they are acting in behalf of God in the works they are doing. They loudly proclaim their belief in miracles, but will never be heard to proclaim their belief in the divine statement that there is one mediator between God and men, the man Christ Jesus. So they counterfeit the truth and they counterfeit God's power through false miracles. So that's symptom number 21. So he says, these also resist the truth. He calls them men of corrupt minds. Their minds are corrupted. They claim, I'm just as knowledgeable, I'm just as capable as these others. And yet what they're doing is they're resisting the truth. They're claiming to have the truth, but they're resisting the truth, just like those two resisted Moses. He says their minds are corrupt. Their thinking is wrong. And they're reprobate concerning the faith. And again, this makes it appear that these are men who claim to have faith in God, but really they're reprobates. They don't truly have faith. They have gone astray from true faith. They're resisting the truth with corrupt minds. Now, this said, all these terrible things that describe people in the last days, what happens? What's the outcome of this? Is this the bad news? Does this just keep going on and on and on? Well, no, it comes to an end. And the glorious truth that it comes to an end, we see in verse 9. He says, but they shall proceed no further. For their folly shall be manifest unto all men, as theirs also was. And Seller says that the idea of they proceed no further is the idea that they are stopped in their tracks. That suddenly something happens that causes them, and we might say in the midst of taking a step, in the midst of their next deed against God, in the midst of their next boastful or proud or stubborn or ungracious thing or whatever it is that they're doing, right in the middle of this, suddenly they're stopped, they're halted. And the result of their stopping, he says, is that their folly will be manifest unto all men as theirs also was. And the falsehood of Jannes and Jambres was shown when Moses finally produced a miracle that they could not counterfeit. And they had to admit in humiliation, this is the true power of God. They got to the point where their arts could no longer keep up with Moses. With the true power of God that Moses is showing, and they had to admit, this is more powerful than we are. This God is more powerful than we. And so he says, just like Jannes and Jambres was manifest to all that they were outclassed, so the folly of these wicked last days men will be manifest to everyone. Everyone will suddenly see clearly the foolishness of this kind of living, of this kind of behaving. Now, what would cause everyone to suddenly see how foolish it is to live in this last day's way? Well, there's nothing that could cause that except the direct intervention of God. The next time we'll take up from here, and I'll show you some other passages which I talk about this, and I believe that this is nothing else but the start of the kingdom of God. So we'll stop there and take up from verse 9 in our next study.